Group meeting, Saturday, 3rd December, 1983. We considered freedom the last weekend here. Freedom from both rejection and acceptance of anything and everything. If there is freedom from both acceptance and rejection from everything, then it is possible to realize a total relationship with life in its wholeness, as matters stand and have stood ever since man has been on the globe. We select certain things which are pleasing to us, agreeable to us, which meet with our approval, and so on, and we reject the opposite. But in that situation, the mind is not really free to inquire, explore, investigate, and discover the truth, the actual truth of things. It is one of the purposes of human evolution, of human development, to be able to accept the totality of life in its wholeness. This is how transcendence, or if you like to use the common garden word God, is in relationship with the whole of life and the universe. We'll talk a little bit more about that a little later on. So that is what we considered last time. When the mind is free, utterly unhindered, that is the whole point, when it is unhindered, then you can discover the truth. But remember, we discover the truth not as something different from us, something at a distance, because that means that we are still conscious in terms of duality and not of the unitary wholeness, which is the actual absolute fact of everything. That duality has to disappear. So what happens is that if the mind is free, it doesn't so much as discover the truth as something external, but it grows into the truth. It becomes the truth. Now, this becoming the truth is really the hallmark of conscious evolution, of the evolution of consciousness. In its culmination, you are conscious of totality in that complete related manner. There is no acceptance, there is no rejection, there is only complete understanding. And this complete understanding, therefore, is the result, and also what it is the result of is the consequence of this total total relationship. Namely, it's the result of compassion and wisdom, essentially. That's what it comes to. This total understanding, so that your consciousness includes everything. Now, that doesn't mean that our ordinary consciousness as we have it at present, which is discriminative consciousness, will cease to be discriminative. It doesn't mean that. Discriminative activity will certainly go on at its own level and on the plane of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. Because here we function, the whole psychophysical being functions in terms of separateness. That we cannot avoid. Your body is your body, not my body. My body is not your body. You see, and so on. So all this functions at our finite and mortal level in its own way, which of course is comes under the purview of our discriminative consciousness as such. But when, through complete understanding, through complete freedom of the psyche from all conditioning, and which means also freedom of the brain from all conditioning, when that comes about, then this transcendent consciousness flowers out. You're conscious in terms of the infinite and the eternal. And at the same time, at this existential level where we find ourselves, it is also you are also discriminatively conscious and can do your work better than anybody else can. So now, this truth which you become absolutely enfolds you. It enfolds you and it inspires you all through your life, all through the day. It is unique to you. By which I mean that your becoming the truth, your consciousness of truth in itself as such, you see, is something which is in a sense different from any other person's truth. It is not contrary to it. It is not a mere agreement with it. It is one of these mysterious things which takes place on the plane of the eternal and the infinite. It's a totally different context. It's a transcendent context. See, where eternity is concerned, there is no before, now, or tomorrow. Where infinity is concerned, there is no here, there, up, down, or anything like that. It's a totally different... It is in fact transcendent altogether. It's very difficult for the brain to fit any description to that sort of thing. What the brain can do through the medium of language and concept is to suggest the transcendent. That's all we can do at our level here, when we are talking or writing or listening or reading or whatever it is. So, your realization of the truth, which really means that the truth, the transcendent, has realized itself uniquely through you. This is the real meaning, I believe, of the statement that the glory is unto God. This is the glory of God, the infinite, immeasurable, incalculable variety through which God or the transcendent, whatever that ultimate transcendent is, manifests itself and fulfills itself through us. And it is only through us that it can manifest itself in terms of consciousness here and now in our existential state. It fulfills itself unconsciously through the plant, through the animal, through the mineral, and so on. The plant doesn't... You get a lovely rose, you get a lovely flower, a daisy or whatever you like, and it's marvelous, it's wonderful, it's transcendence fulfilling itself through that plant, and it doesn't know it. But you and I can know it, can be aware of it. And our awareness is not an analytical, descriptive awareness. It is an awareness which is a constant sort of inspiring power functioning through our whole being. It's that kind of awareness. And it is therefore unique, because every single mortal being is utterly unique. There's no one else like him or her in the world. Never was, is not, never will be. This is the miracle which nature accomplishes in her technique of biological procreation. It's an absolute miracle, but there it is. That every single creature, every single being is utterly unique. If we wake up to our uniqueness through self-control, self-understanding, not so much control as understanding, letting the existential being grow to its fulfillment. Let it grow happily, healthily. And then it all happens like that. Another point we must remember is we mustn't try to acquire anything. Never try to acquire virtue, to acquire wisdom. These things cannot be acquired. Acquire love, beauty, or anything. They just happen. Why do they happen? Because if we fulfill our task of keeping the house clean, so to say, the whole psychophysical organism pure and clean, then all this naturally takes place in the flowering of transcendence through you. That is what happens. And that is perfect beauty. You don't have to go to beauty parlors for it. All acquisition is self-centered. All acquisition. The acquisition of virtue, you can't put on a cloak of holiness. You can be holy naked, completely naked. The psyche, the soul is utterly naked. And then it is really holy. You can't acquire that sort of thing, like a cloak. And whatever is acquired belongs to the sphere of the mortal, the perishable, the completely perishable. Whatsoever virtues, abilities, qualities, excellences we obtain through acquisition, by striving for them and possessing them in accordance with our own petty little conceptions of them, they are all completely mortal. You can't take them with you when you're dead. They all die with the death of the existential being. Completely dead. Make no mistake about it. But this does not mean that we shouldn't work for perfection of whatever abilities we have or gifts with which nature, or if you like to say God or transcendence, endows us. Work for the perfection of those things, because that quality of perfection is a power which works for the well-being and the fulfillment of the whole human race without our knowing it. And the less we know about it personally, the better. Do you think that a rose, for instance, the perfect rose, knows that it is giving such extraordinary joy to you when you smell it? It doesn't know it at all. If it knew it, probably that perfume would cease to be quite so wonderful. Because something is taken away from the complete giving, the complete self-giving, when you become aware of it yourself. And it is lessened. But this perfection affects everyone for good. Take the ordinary examples we have in life. The great poets, composers, artists, sculptors, architects, the great scientists, the great philosophers, the simple peasant who knows just how to do his job properly and perfectly, All this has a universal effect. It is not measurable because of its perfection. Perfection is an immeasurable thing. You can't say, now I've got to the top. You'll certainly get to the top if you become the king of the castle, yes. That's as far as you'll get. But somebody will one day attack that castle and that'll be the end of it. But perfection is something which belongs to the realm of the immortal, to the realm of a beauty which surpasses all thought-out beauty in the world. So, work for the perfection of whatever abilities and gifts you have. The most powerful influence for good, for solving the world's problems and so forth, is simply just what oneself is. Not what one attempts to do for the benefit of the world or your neighbor, your family or country or anything at all. What you are is the most powerful influence. It's a subtle, hidden influence. It cannot be seen. And since it cannot be seen, it cannot be spoilt by anybody. It is invisible. Like God is invisible, and God can't be spoilt, can't be made un-God. We must always remember that there is nothing for oneself, the existential being. This is very important, and it is more or less completely neglected by all mankind, just as it has been neglected throughout the ages. There is nothing for the existential being. It is the transcendent which comes to fruition and fulfillment and so forth. I never realize heaven, but heaven takes me in. And when heaven has taken me in, there is no separate identifiable entity which is me. We have to realize this. The whole existential being is the perishable, the completely perishable. There is no hidden homunculus, this mannequin soul which is declared to be immortal and so forth. That's all nonsense, just wishful thinking. There's no such thing. That's why the Buddha taught anatta, and that's what he really meant. The atta, or the atma, as transcendence itself, is the infinite, the eternal, the immortal. It is that which produces all this, and it is that which reaps the results of all this, pleasant and unpleasant alike. You might wonder, how does God deal with the unpleasant? I'll tell you. You know that marvelous presentation in Hinduism, Shiva drinks the poisoned cup of the world's sorrow to the dregs and converts that poison into nectar. How? Why? Ask God. But you see how it is said in the theistic religions, for instance. All things are possible to God. That is to say, to transcendence, which is the primordial creative energy, which is absolute consciousness, which is fundamental substance. Substance, that which underlies. I don't mean by substance a physical solid object or anything. See, because it is all that, it can do all that sort of thing. But we can't. And strangely enough, And this is the wonderful part of the whole story. The perfecting of the mortal, the perfecting of the perishable existential being influences the imperishable transcendent. What is the sort of supreme spiritual energy underlying the whole evolutionary process? It is precisely this, that which goes through the evolutionary process in its living and more so in its dying presents the imperishable transcendent with that kind of new that kind of power to create something utterly new, to produce the variety. We are indispensable to the transcendent. It is we who release transcendence into its own nirvana, into its own kingdom of heaven, through our dying in the right way. These are difficult things, and they are very easy things also. You see, it is like this. I was born blind, and the years passed, and one day a wonderful doctor came along and showed how I could open my eyes and see. And when I opened my eyes and saw, a miracle took place. My whole understanding of life and myself and the world and everything underwent a complete transformation. Whatsoever was before that went into limbo altogether. Nothing. It's like that. That's how it happens. But it will happen if you let it happen. That is the point. And how does one let it happen? By this, if it is one's inmost passionate desire, passionate longing, that the will of the transcendent, that's a bad phrase, but still, if there is the passionate longing that the transcendent shall function through this and come to its fruition, then it will happen. No amount of study, no amount of learning will do it all. Right inside the existential being is locked up transcendent love and wisdom, purity, goodness, beauty, truth, everything is locked up there. We have only to let it get out, unlock. It will unlock itself. Now, I said the mortal influences the imperishable transcendent. And the situation may emerge in the future when the manifestation of transcendence may be itself transcendent, free of all the limitations, pain, sorrow, decay, and death, which are inextricably interwoven with the existential, finite, and temporal. You know, it's a strange thing that in several other religions, I don't know about several, but at least one or two, it is said that in the ultimate judgment and renovation, and the idea of resurrection is involved in it, that with that ultimate resurrection, whatsoever has resurrected will live immortally. Don't run away with the idea, therefore, that the body, once dead, will ever resurrect. It won't. Because the body contains within itself the elements, the two elements of life, life-producing power and a death-producing power. And the two work together all the time, right through the lifetime of the individual. You can't get away from that. So it is not this which is going to resurrect, and in any case it will be reduced to its original hydrogen and oxygen, sulfur and phosphorus and sodium and all the rest of it. So that's not going to resurrect. But there is some sort of deep meaning involved in this idea. Now, we say that the teachers, we have our own pictures of God, of the teachers, of a Buddha, of a Christ, and so forth. We make our own pictures. And all those pictures are false. Not altogether, but considerably false. Take, for instance, one or two simple points. God is the all-good, the all-loving, the all-perfect, in accordance with our ideas of perfection. And our ideas of perfection are ideas which please us. They don't give us pain. We think of God as caressing us and not slapping us. But supposing God slaps us hard. So hard that our eyeballs pop out. Are we still going to worship that God? Oh, no, 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 that's a rotten God. We want a good chap. Somebody who's nice and kind, sentimental, and all the rest of it. That's the sort of picture we have. Then as regards the great teachers, Zarathustra, or Krishna, or the Buddha, or Christ, or whoever it is, you see, they are all perfect. They are omniscient. We ascribe omnipotence also to some of them and all that sort of thing. And how do we define that omniscience? In terms of encyclopedic knowledge of everything. That they know all about the past, the present, the future. They know all about everything that there is to know at present and will become known in the future. If that were the case, there would have been libraries full of all in detail about the whole of the future. But there aren't. Now, in actual fact, they made several mistakes. All the great holy ones made several mistakes. You see, they were holy men. And what did that holiness mean? That the psychophysical organism was utterly pure and perfect. The physical organism often not so perfect. The Buddha, for instance, died of through getting ill and so forth. That's just one instance. But the psyche is perfect. That means that our what we commonly call our thoughts, feelings, and so on, they were all utterly pure, loving, kind, and so forth. And their omniscience consisted just in this, that they knew precisely the nature of the sick psyche, and they also knew what the purified, healthy, whole psyche was like. This is what our professional psychiatrists do not know. You can't know that unless you yourself have become purified like that. If your psyche is utterly purified, then you can be the real psychiatrist. In the Gathas of Zarathustra, for instance, the phrase used is, he becomes a soul-healing lord of wisdom. That's remarkably sound teaching. What was the Buddha, for instance? He was a doctor of the psyche. He healed the psyche. It's a pity that they have always used the word mind. It's the mind is utterly pure. It's a transcendent, characterless energy. It's a power. It's that power functioning through our brains and nervous system and the activity of the ductus glands and so forth, which produces all our human psychological manifestations and our human psychological life. You see? Now, with respect to all this, they were omniscient. They knew all about it. But apart from that, also, they enjoyed a unitarily whole consciousness. They could enter into the transcendent state of consciousness and also function easily and perfectly in the ordinary everyday state of consciousness, which is of course completely determined by the functioning of our senses and our brain activity through concept and language. So they could function equally in both. But whilst they were holy, and whilst they had this unitarily whole consciousness, they were not infallible in all matters. Far from it. For example, the great teachers did talk of an eternal heaven and an eternal hell. Now, you can, I would like to question immediately. How is it possible for a finite, limited, human mortal to do anything or a whole set of things which are finite and temporal and limited, which deserve an infinite and eternal consequence? Either good or bad. It's just utterly impossible, isn't it? We would, we being what we are, would like to see the nasty people of the world, the Torquemadas and the Hitlers and such like, we would like to see them have a bad time of it. Although what they'd smell like if properly roasted, God knows. We would like that. Why? Because it is a vengeance feeling on our part. That's all. But a reward-punishment idea is a primitive, backward idea altogether. What happens karmically is a healing process, not a reward-punishment process. Neither reward nor punishment will make the psyche whole. It will only give the person pleasure or pain. That is all. But the whole task and the whole purpose of the karmic process is that it so works itself out that the person is healed, made whole. And this is the important thing. But they taught eternal heaven, eternal hell. And even Buddhism and Hinduism, which in some ways had a more sensible vision of things. Even they drew all sorts of terrible pictures of the torments in hell and the joys in heaven and so forth. When I was in Ceylon, in Sri Lanka, in 1960, and I saw so many of their temples there, and the pictures, the frescoes on the walls of the torments of hell, my word, they were simply terrible. But no individual limited entity can possibly do anything to produce an unlimited, eternal, infinite consequence. Why they didn't see that, I don't know. But there we are. Also, there is the assumption in this that there is a separate, identifiable permanent entity called a soul or spirit or something like that, and that it continues in an eternal context. That is an assumption. And it is a false assumption, because in the context of the infinite and of eternity, there is no particularity. There is no such thing as continuity. Everything is immediate here now. And that here now, in terms of the manifestation of the universe as such, is in terms of boundlessness and the point, the immeasurable point. So you see, all this sort of thing is presented in all the religions in a very muddled way. Of course, don't believe a word of what I say. You'll find out for yourself. Otherwise, it'll be no use. Don't believe it. For goodness sake, don't believe it. Consider it and see if this is along lines which are less inadequate and less misleading than the lines which have been laid down in past centuries, past millennia. That is the sensible way to go about it. That's all right. Now, I can give you several examples of to show that the holy ones were in the past, they did not know so many things, and in our ordinary everyday context. Here, for instance, in the third volume of the Digha Nikaya, the Buddha talks in this strain. The ultimate beginning of things I know, and I know not only that, but more than that. How do you know more than the ultimate? And how can you talk of an ultimate in relation to true transcendence, to true infinity or eternity? You can't. And while I know that, I do not pervert it. And as one not perverting it, I even of myself have understood that peace, which, realizing which, a Tathagata can fall into no error. He doesn't qualify the statement by saying, as far as the spiritual state or the spiritual life of man is concerned. No error at all. You see? And so on. And then there is this in another sutta which deals with war, wickedness and wealth. Three W's: war, wickedness and wealth. So he says, so they will practice these virtues, and because of the good that they do, they will increase in length of life and in comeliness, so that the sons of them who lived but 20 years will come to live 40 years, and the sons of these sons will come to live 80 years, and their sons 160 years, their sons 320 years, their sons 640 years, their sons to 2,000 years, and he goes on like that up to 80,000 years. Now I ask you, I'm not saying these things to denigrate any of the holy ones. The holy ones were perfected holy ones. I have complete faith in them with respect to their holiness. But I mean, this sort of stuff is nonsense. Just outright nonsense. The Jain teaching state, they believe in rebirth, that a person goes through 8,400,000 lives and achieves perfection, nirvana. 8,400,000 lives. If he lived even 30 years for each lifetime and was reborn immediately, that would land you into near 25 million years. 25 million years. How many million years has man been on the planet? I ask you again. You see, if we therefore are free in our minds from acceptance as well as rejection, then the mind is open, it is ready to understand, to see clearly. And that clear-sightedness will show us just where perfected holy ones should speak and where they should not speak. You see, we can leave this, and I'll leave this business about the explanations he gives of earthquakes. Those of you who were at the summer school last year, Buddhist summer school this year, know I quoted all that, you see. If the Buddha's explanations of earthquakes were true, and they are really ridiculous, you know, the way they are put. If they were true, then it is a terrible thing that a Buddha should be born, should find enlightenment, and should finally pass away, and should start teaching and pass away. Because each time it is accompanied by a terrible earthquake. And you know what an earthquake does to human beings? How can the Lord of compassion and wisdom talk in such terms? But there you are. That's how it is. At least that's how the teachings have come down in the written word. But there are so many such things with which one can find fault. And find fault quite justifiably and rightly. Because these things are just not true. Did you ever come across anybody who was 80,000 years old? Just cannot be done, you see. Now, I think just one other thing we have time for. The Zarathustra taught that the being of God himself, Ahura Mazda is the name in Zarathustrianism, the being of Ahura Mazda is the source of the Holy Spirit, the good spirit, and the bad spirit. So that all evil and trouble and so forth also proceeds from God, just as good proceeds from God. You see? Now that may seem a terrible doctrine, but I wouldn't be surprised if there was some misconception as regards translating the Avestan words. On the other hand, they may have been correctly translated as good and evil, you see, and that God is responsible for both. Because look, in Deuteronomy, the Lord God says to Moses, "See, I have set before thee this day life and good, and death and evil." And a little further he says, "I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life that both thou and thy seed may live." So you see, it's the same teaching actually. I've spent quite a lot of time looking into these two statements by Zarathustra and by Jehovah. Moses really, repeating what Jehovah told him. So you get these extraordinary things, but they have one tremendous value. Neither accept nor reject. Consider, understand, and realize. When you can see both completely, see the underlying truth of it all, then the two apparently conflicting duals become complementary duals, and they are integrated into a whole transcendent understanding of what is the actual thing. And you transcend the conflict which you yourself undergo with respect to the duals. Our described God in all the religions throughout the world, poets and everybody, our described God is not a conscious realization in samadhi, in the supreme state of consciousness possible to human beings, of the actuality of transcendence. That actuality is indescribable, because description belongs not to the realm of transcendence, but to the realm of manifestation, where there is division and separation and all the rest of it. Therefore, it can't be described. The God can't be described. I have not denied God or transcendence. And I have said these things not to deprive anybody of his faith, but rather to suggest that his faith can become profounder and deeper and truer faith if he will just consider all these things very, very carefully. And in that consideration, the true asceticism takes place, because you slough off the unnecessary. Thank you.